Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the mid-1990s, Donal Gray was a rising star in the football scene. He'd played for both the under 16 and 18 sides for Northern Ireland, and his career had taken him to Scotland. In July 1996, he'd just finished the season with Irish League club Glenavon when he was subjected to a brutal attack that would not only end his career, but also his dreams. In a so-called punishment attack carried out by the IRA, both Donal's legs were broken after a gang of masked men forced their way into his Newry home. Donal was the 400th victim of these so-called punishment attacks. Donal, you're very welcome on today's podcast.
Thanks very much, Patricia. Thanks for having me.
Donal, you grew up in Newry.
Yeah.
Born in 1977, during the Troubles. What was Newry like at that time?
Well, growing up as a child in Newry, there was always, you knew what was happening around you. There was lots of bombs and shootings and different things, but my life was just football from very early to whenever, you know, as long as I can remember, it was just football mad.
And it was soccer that you were just fixated with. Who was your favourite team?
Oh, I'm a Liverpool supporter, yeah, and Celtic, obviously, so, yeah.
So that was your favourite teams, I think you told me you had been playing from you were a toddler.
Yeah, I played football since I was a toddler. Now, I started playing for teams maybe under eights from then upwards, just for local teams and stuff, you know.
So football was just your life,
yeah,
and that was your love?
I played for so many teams at different times, and at the same time I was playing for playing for a team in Belfast, I was playing for teams in Dublin. And in Newry, you know, it was just, yeah, I'll play, you know.
So when did your talent start to shine through?
Well, it was during the summer, maybe it was around 13 or 14, say, and a soccer school came to Newry, and it was run by a guy from Wales called Tony Williams. And he travelled all around the country just doing these soccer schools, and he eventually picked a team to go to a tournament in Holland, and I got on the team. So that's when I said to myself, oh, well, I'm all right if I'm making a team throughout the whole country, you know. So yeah, that was my first real experience of travelling. And
what age were you then?
I think it was 14 or 15.
Brilliant.
So yeah,
and that's when your career then started to rocket. You played for Northern Ireland, the youth international squad.
Yeah, well, I got trials for the under 15s, and I got to the last day, and I wasn't picked, so I was devastated. But then they came around the next year, and I made the team. Then, you know, so that was good. Also playing in the Milk Cup in Portrush, Coleraine. So I played for County Down 2 years in a row. So that was sort of your first professional style playing, you know, because it was, you had team tracksuits and you were staying in a hotel, and it was just wow, I like this, you know.
And with the Northern Ireland squad, were you playing in different parts of the world or what?
Yeah, we travelled all over Europe playing. We played against Austria and I can't remember who else was in the group, but we qualified for the European Championships in Turkey. So that's we travelled there and it was amazing. Just you were treated like royalty, you know, and it was...
What was the dream, Donald?
Well, the dream was to play professionally in either Scotland or England or anybody who would have me, really, you know. So that was it. Like, nothing else was in my mind, just...
That was it. You were just football mad. It was your love, your passion. Nothing else mattered. And you actually did go and play in Scotland. What age were you then?
I was 17 when I left to play for Partick Thistle. And yeah, but I was only there for a year, but things moved very quickly when I got there. I started off playing in the youth team and played so many games in the youth team, and then I was in the reserve team. And then eventually you got a call up to the first team.
What was the feeling like when you got that call? You were on the first team?
Unbelievable. Like, it was, you're playing against your heroes, some of them, you know. And I remember one time I was in the squad to play against Celtic. And I love Celtic, you know, and these players were my heroes, you know. So my dad and my brother came over to watch that match. And I'm getting photographs taken with all the Celtic players and stuff, you know.
And playing against them?
Yeah, and the manager gave off to me, says you could be playing against these boys today, you know. So stop that.
And how long did you stay in Scotland for?
Well, it was there roughly about a year for a full season. And my mum died then and I come home and sort of... Just, I didn't want to go back. It just hit me hard, and I didn't want to go back, and eventually I never went back.
You're just home, and you're being a normal teenager, going out, and I suppose with losing your mum, that's a huge loss in your life, and of course you're going to lose focus for a bit, you know, it's a big life change, and you know that's your mum.
Yeah, well, I was the youngest, and it hit me hard. And it was just all over the place. I didn't know what to do or what to think. I was just being a teenager, going out and partying and going to nightclubs. And
so, Donald, take me back to the events that happened around that time, personally, with yourself.
Well, I was playing away football for Glenavon, and I was just being a normal teenager, going out and, as I say, partying and different things, and
the rave scene was big then.
So there was a couple of good nightclubs, Armand, the Arena and stuff, and yeah, it was like a whole new thing, you know. Wow, this is great. Yeah. So yeah, just doing that kind of thing, and so
how did you come to the attention of the IRA then?
Well, I would say that, now, I grew up with loads. You knew who everybody was and what they were, you know, growing up. And I always got on with everybody. Never had any arguments with them or anything like that. So things started to change slightly in their attitude towards me. Like, stop talking to you, giving you dirty looks as you're walking down the street. So the mood had changed.
Because you grew up in a Republican estate, Barcroft was an estate that basically was controlled by IRA.
Yeah, everything. And so you noticed it when the mood changed, you know. But I didn't think that anything was going to happen to me, you know. I wasn't doing anything wrong for anything to happen, so that was never in a thought, you know. But then... they tried to get a friend of mine. Now, the punishment beatings were getting more frequent, so there was people getting beat up every other day. So, you know, it did cross your mind then, oh, I hope this doesn't happen to me. And then you would think, well, maybe I'll get a warning first or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But nothing happened. And they tried to get a friend of mine the night before.
And what was their reasoning behind that? Do you ever get a reasoning?
They never came in contact with me apart from an ex-prisoner. Now, he was inside at the time. And he got out on day release or weekend release or something after the Good Friday Agreement. So he came and apologised, but it wasn't on the behalf of the IRA. It was just more or less saying, like, he found out and it wasn't sanctioned. So it was just...
This was the attack that was carried out and it wasn't sanctioned. No. And so going to that attack, 10 o'clock, you're in your house...
Yeah, I'm at home, and as I said, Drumcree was happening. There was a lot of rioting going on and a lot of hijackings. And the estate I lived in was completely closed off by hijacked lorries and vans, and all the entrances in and out were all blocked off, so you knew something was going to happen, you know.
And was that to stop the security forces getting in?
Yeah, I would imagine so. But... So yeah, the mood was you could feel it, you know. So as I said, they tried to get my friend the night before, and I was with them the night before, and so if they really wanted to get me, I was there the night before, you know. So anyway, I went home that night. The next day, it was later on, 10 o'clock, and I was standing out the front of the house, and I could see a crowd starting to gather up at the end of the street, and I could recognise some faces, and I knew something was going to happen, you know, just got a bad feeling. So I eventually went out onto the street, and I was talking to two friends, and they kept passing, the IRA kept passing in a car, and I says, right, they're keeping an eye on me, there's something's going to go down here, you know.
You knew you were being watched.
Yeah. So when the coast was clear then, my dad was visiting a neighbour across the road. So when the coast was clear, I went into his house. And we sat there, and I was afraid to say anything to my dad, and I didn't want to, you know. It was maybe looking back, I should have. But anyway, I didn't want to say anything. And eventually we went to go home, and... when he opened the front door, there was 10, 15 of them standing outside my own house. And you could have heard a pin drop that night. It was so just silent. And they obviously heard the door opening. And they all just turned round. And I looked and I just closed the door and I says, Dad, I'm getting done here. I'm getting done. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? Within 10, 15 seconds, they were at the door. And they eventually got into the house then. They put a gun to my head, they put a gun to my dad's head, and dragged me out into the front garden.
And that's where you were attacked?
Yeah.
They used steel rods?
They had iron bars and like pickaxe handles with nails through them. So baseball bats, I suppose anything that they could get their hands on, really.
Were these men masked?
They were all masked, when they entered the house and in the garden and stuff, yeah.
And they just attacked you all over your body?
Yeah, from head to toe.
Was the focus on your legs?
The focus was on my legs. Now, I knew that from the start, that there was a lot of beating around the legs. Now, I did get beaten in the upper body, but mostly my legs. So they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were setting out to do, you know.
And as this attack was happening to you, Donal, what was going through your head? And did you feel any pain?
I didn't feel any pain at the time. You just go numb. Your body just goes numb. But the only thought that was going through my head was football and never being able to play it again, you know.
How long did the attack last? Do you have any idea?
I think it lasted for around 10 minutes.
10 minutes? Were they saying anything as they were attacking you?
Yeah, you're going to die, you bastard. Call me a druggy bastard. That's all they said. There was nothing else, really. And then I always remember just this word, right, disperse. And as just like that, they just walked away. Didn't run, didn't...
And they called you a druggie?
Yeah.
So... was there reasoning that you were involved in drugs, or what was that about?
I was never involved in drugs, but as I said at the time, it was the start of the rave scene, and we dabbled in different things like ecstasy and stuff, and going out and raving, you know, but never involved in selling anything or anything like that. So, but it was like the attitude: if you're not with us, you're against us, and you're pissed against each other, strange. You know, kind of thing, you know.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Yeah, it was strange.
You were left in that garden. I take it your dad came to your aid?
Yeah, my dad was there. My brother eventually came after, I don't know, somebody must have told him, and he came, and a few neighbours were there.
When did the ambulance arrive?
The ambulance never got there. It could have been 2 or 3 hours.
You were in a garden, lying badly beaten for 3 hours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had all the roads blocked, so the ambulance literally couldn't get in. So eventually they got in somehow. And yeah, I was taken to Daisy Hill then and transferred a couple of days later to the City Hospital in Belfast.
When did you realise that your legs had been so badly injured?
Well, there was that much bruising and swelling, so the doctors didn't really... Well, they knew that my legs were broke because of x-rays and stuff, but they couldn't really assess anything until all the swelling went down. So eventually I needed some operations on my knee, and I was in plaster from head to toe, and yeah...
When did the doctors eventually tell you then, Donal, that your legs were possibly damaged?
Well, there was that much damage done to my left knee that he said to me, because I was constantly asking him, will I be able to play football again, you know? So eventually he says, not at the level that you were playing at. So...
What was it like to hear that, Donal?
It's devastating, because during school and all, it was just football. I wasn't focused on anything else. In careers class, you know, it was just what you want to be when you leave school, and it was football. It was nothing else.
How did your family console you during this? Because, I mean, that's your dreams nearly broken right in front of you.
Yeah, it was hard for my dad... because after it happened, and I lost track of myself for a long time, you know. And it was very hard on him, because he was going through his own thing, because he was there, you know. So I have no idea. We never ever talked about it. So I don't know what way he felt, you know.
He had to deal with his own trauma as well.
Yeah.
I mean, when they were shouting at you in the garden that you're going to, they're going to kill you. Did she think that they were going to kill you at any stage?
You know, it took me years and years, and I never thought it at the time, but it took me years and years. And when I thought about it then, and I says, like, I was so fit and so strong at the time. If it had been somebody not as fit or strong, every bone in my body would have been broke. And I think that's what helped me at the time, because they didn't hold back, you know. It was
10 people with weapons just beating you for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so how long did you have to spend in hospital?
I spent a few days in Daisy Hill before I was transferred, and then it was 3.5 weeks to 4 weeks in the city hospital. And I was in bedridden for most of that time.
And meanwhile, the press heard about the attack on you, and you were on the front page of national newspapers and in the UK and Ireland, and people were appalled at the attack. And it actually says in one UK national that you were the 400th victim of IRA punishment beatings. 400th victim.
Yeah, I don't even know what the number is today, but it's a lot more than that.
I know, it's still, and these attacks still happen.
Still happen, yeah.
Paramilitary still carry them out. And when you hear about these attacks in the news, then, Donal, you know, how do you feel?
It just brings everything back, you know, you know, 99% of these attacks, people just don't deserve them, and it's true personal grudges than anything else, most of them, you know. And the tell the public that it's drugs or something else, it's just a cover, like,
yeah,
you know.
So-called punishment attacks. I mean, like you say, some of these attacks, and I remember Andrew Allen in Buncrana, he's from Derry, he lost his life during one of these attacks, and his family said, this wasn't a punishment attack. This was a personal grudge carried out by a paramilitary.
Yeah, and that's, I would say most of them have that same reason.
The recovery, I mean, must have been very long. How long are you talking?
Well, it took me, the injuries themselves took over a year for to heal, not properly, just to be able to walk again. I was a long time on crutches, and then eventually was able to walk again, but I couldn't bend my knee for well over a year.
One of your kneecaps was completely shattered.
Yeah.
How was the pain? How did you deal with it?
Oh, lots of painkillers, but Yeah, as I said, the psychological damage was far more to deal with than the actual pain of the injuries, you know.
And did you still have that hope, Donald, that you would go and play out in the field again?
Yeah, it was mixed emotions, you know. It was like your fantasy land. You think that you could fully recover, but then you think then, no, listen, there's no chance. And I knew with the extent of my knee that I was never going to be able to play top level football again. That was just...
When did you kick a football again after that?
It was maybe 4 years, 3 or 4 years after the attack, and I started to play for a couple of local teams. And as I said, I literally gave up watching football for a long time and couldn't watch anything because I was seeing friends and I was thinking what could have been, you know. But eventually I played for a couple of local teams and it sort of brought good feelings back, you know. And I eventually got a bad injury playing for one of the local teams, and that's when I stopped altogether. It's just that I think my body had been through that much that things were starting to fall apart, you know.
Yeah. When did you come to the realisation that you had to give up your dream?
Well, it was after... it wasn't long after the attack, but with the extent of the injuries, I didn't think that I was going to play any kind of level again, you know, even Irish League level. I just wouldn't have been up. The recovery after a game was just... It was going into weeks. And so I would never be able to keep that up if I played for any Irish League team or anything, you know.
How did you cope then with having to give up something that you were so passionate about and loved from you were a toddler?
Yeah, really, really hard. And you try to forget about everything, you know, you block things out. And as I said, I didn't want to watch football. It just totally shut everything out, you know.
I see now that you've got your Northern Ireland caps on the wall with your medals and yeah. Everything. And I mean, going from not being able to watch football to having that on your wall, does it get hard to look at sometimes? Or are you just proud like you should be of what you achieved?
Yeah, I am. I'm very proud of what I achieved. And when I was so young as well, you know. But then there is times where it brings different emotions and stuff, thinking about bringing the past up again. But I'm very proud of all the medals and caps and all. So yeah, it was great times, and that's the way I have to sort of think about it to get over it, you know.
And how do you cope? Because I know, Donal, you have said that you still suffer from the psychological effects of what happened. You have post-traumatic stress disorder, and you know, how has it been getting help for that?
I never got help after it happened. And I remember going to the doctors, and I used to get the same dream every night. And I didn't understand what it was or why I was getting this. I remember telling my doctor at the time, and he just shrugged it off. He sort of, "Oh, that happens, you know." And I never got help. I never went to see any therapists or anything. And it's only recently, in the last 10 years, where I've been going to get help.
And so, that's a big step. And sadly, in the past, there hasn't been that much for people. And you were basically a victim of the Troubles because you were attacked by a paramilitary organisation. Do you look at yourself as a victim, or?
I do sometimes. Yeah, I do, but it's hard to explain, you know.
Look at how far you've came, Donal, and today is a big thing for you because you're actually sitting here talking to me and you've told me that you haven't been able to talk about this to very many people, and that's a huge achievement.
No, I never talk about it to nobody, and I always, if it's brought up, I just brush it off, you know, and put on a brave face. But it hurts every day, you know. It's never too far away from your thoughts, and it's just very hard. It's the aftermath of what happened is far more to deal with than the actual injuries and the incident, you know.
Do you think, do any of the people who attacked you that night realise what they have done to you?
Oh, they know. They know, you know. I've got anonymous letters in the post in the past of telling me of certain people what they were talking about in bars that they were overheard saying and stuff, you know.
About you?
Yeah, about the attack.
And were these anonymous letters trying to help you in some
way? Yeah, but it just brought everything up again, and I never kept the letter. I threw it away. And it's just, that was just my way of dealing with things, because there was no point trying to find out who it was. I had no idea, you know.
You did give a statement to the police. You know some of the people that were involved, but that just wouldn't be something.
No, you could never talk about names or anything like that. But I grew up with these people. Some of them were friends.
Do you ever see them anymore? Do they walk past you in the street?
Yeah, listen, some of them talk to me now, and for years I never spoke to them. And I would, you know, because a lot of anger towards them, and what could I do for revenge and stuff? And it's just...
It eats you up.
Yeah, it does. It really does. But as years went on, then, you know, that you lose all that and you sort of settle down then. But yeah, I meet them all the time. Not so much now because I'm not living in the town centre. But yeah, every day.
Do you think, is there any guilt there?
No, they don't care.
What advice would you give to anyone who's struggling? Donal, you were the 400th victim in 1996. Like we've said, there's been more after that. You know, was there any advice you would give to someone who has been victim to these attacks?
Yeah, talk about it. Get help, any help you can get. Because I went through for years with no help and trying to deal with it myself. And I just couldn't cope with doing that, you know. And just to not feel the shame, because there's a stigma put on you from getting that. And it's, you know everybody's looking at you and they're thinking, what did he do? And it's that kind of stigma that you feel shame upon yourself, because you actually start to think then, what was it me? Did I do something wrong? You know? So I know I never talk about it much, but it does help, and it feels like a big thing off your shoulders, and you do eventually talk about it, you know.
Honestly, Donal, I think you're very brave, and I'm privileged that you've sat down and spoken to me about it. I know it's not easy reliving that attack, and like you say, the psychological scars are still there. I just want to wish you all the best, and I mean, I'm sure if anyone needs any help or needs to talk, that you'd be more than willing to speak to them.
Yeah. As I said, it's thank God it's nearly a thing of the past now, and there's not so many. It still happens, but there's not so many as there was back then. And there's a lot more help out there for people than they think, you know. So I would urge anybody to go and speak to people, doctors, anybody, friends, family.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.